Ed, if you're doing that, I understand, you know, at least demonstrating the edges of the envelope, if you will, but does that not impart some level of negative training? Because now you have somebody that overshoots center. They figure, hey, in training, I got this airplane to 60 degrees of bank. I'm going to salvage a bad situation rather than just abandon it and come back around.
Excellent question. And the answer to that is that one of the expanded envelope exercises is a deliberate runway overshoot. The pilot flies base until the mentor tells him to turn final, and he normally doesn't tell him to turn final until he's past the runway center line. Then aligned, you know, we say, align yourself one runway width to the left. Go over and align yourself one runway width to the right. Go align on the left side of the runway, to the right side of the runway. Now land one expansion joint off to the side. So rather than giving people false confidence, we try and expose them to scenarios. This is not truly scenario-based training, but we try to expose them so that they've got a bunch of tools in their toolbox, and their envelope is not, the only way I can land is by staying on the very center line when I turn base to final. I can overshoot, and my envelope is big enough that I can handle it.
So how do you sell this? We're trying to get this out to as many people as possible. There's a bunch of folks up here with hardware, which is more traditional. How do you literally sell this? How do you sell this to the pilot population and make them want to do this?
That's an excellent question, and this gets into the area of marketing. Part of it is that there's nothing to install. You can do this in everyday airplanes. Part of it is to gain industry support, universities, transition trainings. I was talking to Texas Aircraft today about their transition training and how this could fit in with them. The name, Keeping Our Friends Alive, is a marketing tool. If we say we want to reduce the loss of control accident rate, who cares? If we say we want you to be a better pilot, well, what did I do wrong? But if we say we want to keep our friends alive, that gives it some momentum and some acceptability. So it's going to take, to make any of these safety initiatives work, it's going to take the universities, the commercial flight schools, the alphabet organizations, the CFIs, the vendors. It's going to be industry-wide to get the support.
So what are you going to do with the money to do that?
Go visit a lot of folks. Another thing is that to get data back from E3 and how it's been used, one of the things to do is to say, if you go off and do this transition training, and you fill out the form, I'll give you $50. There's lots of things.
I got to go back to my original question. I don't want somebody rolling the airplane 60 degrees in a bank turn at 200 feet trying to salvage a bad situation to get back on center or even make the pavement. So how is it that expanding that envelope to that extent, I mean, I understand that they're going to understand the performance a little better, but the last thing I want is them to be imparted with the at least false belief that they can salvage a bad situation at 200 feet overshooting center.
That's an excellent point. And to be honest, it's one I'd not thought of. And part of that, as I was saying, is because we already have the runway overshoot and runway alignment exercise as part of E3. That has been well received at Utah Valley University. The only problem with training that is frequently they have too much traffic to let the pilots do this on a 3-mile final to give them room to do the exercise.
Yeah, so what Greg's getting at, I think, is where is the boundary between feeling more comfortable with a broader set of performance demands you put on the airplane and where is your judgment kick in? Have you mapped these exercises to specific loss of control scenarios, root causes, etc.? How did you develop them and how do they map to preventing someone from exercising bad judgment as opposed to truly learning the capabilities of the airplane and having the ability to understand how to take that expanded performance understanding and turn it into better judgment?
Well, that's an excellent question, and it has many parts. One is that judgment is, strictly speaking, not part of E3, but the other interesting part of E3 is that if you look at all the causes that the psychologists have given us for loss of control, we don't address each of those causes. We recognize that they all have the same symptom. So we treat the symptom, and that will address the underlying causes. So that's part of the answer to your question. But judgment, let's put it this way. There is no one tool for aviation safety. You've heard the saying, if the only tool you've got in your toolbox is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. E3 is a great tool to have in your toolbox, but it's not the be-all and end-all.
So is it your intent for this to be a public domain package?
Eventually. What needs to happen is that there are some risks. You can get some real unusual attitudes, as I found out the first time I was doing 60-90s with a subject pilot, and we got into an 80-degree bank and 38 degrees nose down, and the horizon was up here somewhere. So this has to be put out in a careful manner so that Joe instructor doesn't say, oh, I can do that, and surprise himself.
So what does that package look like, and does it include instructor training to precede all this?
Right now, the package includes instructions to the mentor pilot on how to conduct the exercises. Each of the exercises talks about the risks and talks about other characteristics of that exercise that will be important so that it can be safely taught.
And what media are you using? Is it multimedia?
Plain text.
Plain text. YouTube?
Sheets of paper.
Okay.
So one thing I'd take a little bit of issue with, and maybe it was just for a point of emphasis you were making there, is you didn't see a need to go out and train to do spins in a pits. This wasn't about spins and stalls. Would you not agree, though, that there is some benefit in enhancement training for any of us to go get stall and spin training in an aerobatic airplane, or even some modicum of introduction to aerobatic training? How can this be by itself an answer without having exposure? Rod Machado used to sit on this panel, and he would say, we've gotten to a point where even some of our instructors are afraid to teach stalls because they're not comfortable doing them themselves. So what I'm envisioning is if you were successful, this could get imparted into syllabus for basic flight training, and yet we seemingly are moving to narrow the envelope that we train to in our syllabus rather than expanding it.
Well, you raised a couple of interesting questions. One is, when do you get all this information? When do you put it into the flight syllabus? That's what the folks at Utah Valley are going to be looking at. And while spins and those things are interesting to learn, they're expensive to learn. You can't do them in your own unmodified airplane. And before you get to a spin, an inadvertent spin, you're going to be in a place where you're not manipulating the controls properly, and you're going to be in a state of cognitive unavailability. So yes, you want to learn spins, but you also want to learn how to stop before you get there.
So would you package this for various types of different airplanes? I could imagine somebody has some exotic airplane and maybe some of these aren't applicable to that particular one. Would you try and go airframe by airframe or leave it open-ended?
Well, absolutely. One of the ideas is that the expanded envelope exercises should have significant positive transfer from airplane to airplane. But if you have a plane that's overly stable, you'll be fighting the stability characteristics and you won't learn the lessons. If you have a plane that is twitchy near high angle of attack, maybe some of the exercises would be excessively high risk. So the exercises should have positive transfer, but you don't want to just throw them over the fence and say good luck.
All right, very good. Thank you, Ed. We really appreciate your presentation.
Thank you.
We'd like now to bring Ethan Brodsky and his buzz ball to the stage. And so while they're doing the transition, I do want to point out, if you take a look at our awards table, not only do we have just really the lovely awards along with the Master Award designed by EAA member Alan Westby, but we also have these gorgeous aircraft models generously donated by Airbus and their support for what we're doing here today. Not just their broader support of the Experimental Aircraft Association, but their particular interest in generating research, development at the grassroots level in order to be able to tackle many of the wicked problems that we see here in experimental and amateur home-built and general aviation aircraft. So, kind of looking back a little bit, gentlemen, is there a particular, could you talk about last year's Founders Innovation Prize?
There you go.
And,
so, quick idea.
Charlie, thanks, Greg. Involuntary.
We have had some pretty, I think, inspiring winners when we've had some that were very young groups up here, high school kids that have won. And so we're seeing a really broad array of entries. So let's just keep them coming.
Excellent. Well, with that, Ethan, you have 7 minutes. Go.
I'd like to thank the organizers, the judges, the AA, and Airbus for putting this great event together. My innovation is of the widget family. It is a seat cushion with two vibrating actuators, little buzzers in it, that help you keep the ball centered. So I've loved aviation all my life. I've been a longtime enthusiast, attendee, member of EAA. I learned to fly in 2012, and I now fly a Wagabond, and I'm building a Sea Ray Amphibian. So many, many people have written a lot and built a lot of inventions and done a lot of work in trying to reduce fatalities associated with stalls and spins. And so the general theme of my talk is that the turn coordinator, although I know a lot of people love it, is not a great instrument. And what is wrong with the turn coordinator? The biggest problem is that it requires that a pilot look at it to be effective. The visual system is already busy when you're flying. It's especially true when you're task saturated. And it's really important to have your eyes outside when you're maneuvering in the pattern or at low altitude. The turn coordinator, it's a passive instrument. It doesn't alert you to hazards like an audible or stick shaker stall warning. So my hypothesis is that providing additional coordination feedback via the pilot's sense of touch will increase the pilot's ability to recognize and correct uncoordinated flight, reducing incidents of loss of control due to uncoordinated stalls and saving lives.